Well, hello, and welcome one more time to another Political Shadings podcast. I am your host, John Lawyer.
And I am your co-host, Andrew Goldberg.
Here we are again at the intersection of the green economy and policy and business and energy efficiency and...
common sense, perhaps?
I don't know about that. At least in this room. And we are coming to you live from the Big Wig Media Studios in the Willard Office Complex. Beautiful downtown Washington, D.C., two blocks from the White House, 72 degrees and sunny.
Pollen levels at 247 million.
I can't see or breathe.
Exactly, yeah.
And we are part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. So we would like to thank them both for their hard work on our behalf. We also want to thank Joshua Espinosa. The intro music you just heard was composed by Joshua. He is a fabulous studio and jazz musician, joshuaespinosa.com. We can't thank him enough for that. And frankly, I think we get more compliments on him than we do the actual podcast.
I think that's true.
Yeah. And we, of course, want to thank our corporate sponsor, Somfy North America. Jackie Hankard, the newest member of our podcast team. Jackie, why don't you tell us a little bit about Somfy? Take it away.
For more than 50 years, Somfy has been driving durable, positive motion as a pioneer in window and door automation. Developed with comfort, ease of use, security, and sustainability in mind, our seamless and connected solutions are designed to help people make the move to living spaces impactful for humans and with a reduced impact on nature.
Thanks, Jackie. Always lovely to hear from you. And here we are again.
Once again.
But we have somebody with us.
We do.
We have somebody in the studio.
We're not alone, are we?
We are not. Gerald Kearse, a very beloved former colleague and friend of mine. Gerald Kearse is the CEO of a company called Trustable. Gerald, how are you doing today?
I'm good. By the way, you guys have great chemistry, great podcast chemistry. It's
Thank
very
you.
Clear.
We first found each other on on Tinder or something. Yeah. I don't know. We're one of those.
It's one of the apps.
Yeah.
You make a great couple.
That's great.
Well, he is the yin to my yang.
I'm the bacon to the eggs or something. Or
something like
Scooby
that.
Scooby to the Doo.
Yeah. like a Scooby-Doo ghost town,
exactly.
Much like downtown Washington, D.C. So we have Gerald in studio with us, and he's going to talk to us about the intersection of business, artificial intelligence, governance, and policy, and how that all works together. But Andrew, as per usual, why don't you attempt to tell us what's going on here in our nation's capital and how it affects our good listeners?
Sure. Well, you know, today's theme, if I can, is coalition government. So,
wow.
So I'm sure you may know that in much of the democratic world,
yep.
In many countries, they have parliaments and they have these so-called coalition governments. When you have three or more parties.
So the majority can't quite eke out a majority.
Exactly. One party doesn't win all the seats, so they have to join forces with other parties.
The link arms
together.
It's very exciting.
To create a viable coalition, which means that some of the smaller parties have the ability, the power to influence the agenda. Right. Now,
okay.
Now that's fairly normal. Some places it works great. Some places like Italy, where they've had, I think, a new government every year practically because of some of that sort of inter-party chaos. Doesn't always work, but sometimes it does.
Yep.
But you know, for us here in the U.S., that's not how we do things, right? We have essentially two major parties, Republicans.
We elect a majority, we elect a minority.
Right, Republicans, Democrats. That's pretty much it. And normally there is one or the other is in charge, the other one is the opposition. Well, things are a little different these days. And they've been for a while, but they've really come to a head because in the House right now, as you well know, there are about 217 Republicans, about 213 or so Democrats. There actually have five vacant seats. And because the Republicans are, as you may well know, as we've talked about, you know, they're not getting along so well. There's a lot of different kind of interest, personalities, folks. And because their margins are so narrow, it is frankly really hard for Republicans, even though they do have more seats, to actually gain a working majority. And so over the last couple of years, we've seen this really play out a lot, but it's come to a head this past week when it came time to take up legislation.
Finally,
after months, to provide funding to Ukraine, to Israel, to Taiwan, and some other pieces.
Now, whatever your politics and personal beliefs are whether the United States should be funding these efforts in these other countries. It is an established belief amongst the majority of both Americans and a coalition majority in Congress that we should be acting as such, correct?
That's correct, and that's, you hit the nail on the head, a coalition. There are, clearly, there has been a big majority of members of the House, as well as members of the Senate, who support providing this funding.
And you're talking 300 members of the 435.
Exactly, a clear majority. The problem has been, though, that Republicans, as a majority party, they themselves can't deliver the majority. They can't get a majority of votes because they're
about anything.
Well, about anything, but especially about this. And in fact, the opposition from some Republicans to providing funding for Ukraine has been so strong that some members have threatened to oust the current Speaker of the House
if he brought up a bill.
Now, again, this may sound like you're just listening to a rerun.
Right. You know, this is a new episode, folks.
New episode. This is not Groundhog Day.
Right.
But you're right. Last fall, of course, they ousted the former Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Over some stopgap funding, keeping the government open. Well, this time you have a member who I'm sure some people may have heard of, a well-known member named Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Never heard of her.
Never heard? Really? That's surprising.
Yeah,
I think you have.
Yeah.
From Georgia.
I might have. Yeah.
And she and a few others have said to Speaker Johnson, well, if you bring up the Ukraine funding, we're going to kick you out. And Speaker Johnson has faced a choice. And people have said, and I think it's been a real criticism of him that he has dithered on this funding for a while. You've seen what's happened in Ukraine where they're out of bullets, out of ammunition, being threatened by Russia. Of course, in Israel, you have, of course, a very ongoing war. You had the attack on Israel by Iran a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, Taiwan is always sort of under this threat. And basically, Speaker Johnson faced a real choice, either bring up this funding and potentially face elimination or an ouster,
right?
Or do nothing, put your head in the sand, and survive.
And he chose.
He chose to do it. And something really weird happened. Now, I have to get a little wonky here. Is that okay if I get a little bit wonky?
That has nothing to do with this podcast whatsoever.
Sorry. Yeah, I know. It's a little wonky, but okay. So in the House of Representatives,
yeah.
Before you bring a bill to the floor of the House, it has to go through something called the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee is always, yeah, it's like a chorus.
Right.
Repeat
again,
after.
Great couple.
Yeah.
Exactly. We finish each other's
words.
Sandwiches. Yeah, exactly. there's a Rules Committee, which always has this huge partisan tilt towards the majority party. 9 Republicans, 4 Democrats. And the Rules Committee job is to set the terms, the rules for debate on the House floor.
For each bill.
Right. And in the committee, it is a given. The majority members will vote to approve the rule. The minority party votes against it. That's just the way things are. It's partisan. Well, this time, Kevin McCarthy had put onto the Rules Committee 3 hard right members. This was part of the deal he set to become Speaker about a year ago.
Speaker in the first place.
Right. Those 3 said, no, we're so opposed to the Ukraine aid that we're going to vote against the rule. What that meant was that in order for the rule to pass, to even get it to the floor, Democrats had to come to the rescue. And so Democratic members of the Rules Committee had to vote in favor of the rule. Now, to most people out there, i.e. normal people...
That's like, oh, what's the big
what's
deal?
What's the deal? But for Washington...
But for us, that's never happened.
It's never happened. Never happened before, ever.
Right.
Where you have Democrats come in. So what it essentially means is that Democrats essentially became part of this governing coalition to move this bill forward.
Right. This sounds almost Canadian to me.
Dare you say Canadian or British
or British.
Something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Could bring out the poutine and the Zambonis. But it is. But again, this is a situation.
Poutine's delicious.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
Who doesn't love French fries, gravy,
I lived in Montreal for several years.
I can't
tell you how delicious poutine is.
Yeah. But we digress.
Yeah.
But right. But so basically, you had to have Democrats becoming part of the governing majority, this coalition, to get this bill passed. And it did. All this aid passed. Is going to pass the Senate today, probably. So Ukraine will get the funding it needs, Taiwan, et cetera. But what it really shows is that Republicans have, for all intents and purposes, lost functional control of the House, which they are in the majority party in.
Right. Now, in addition to that, it's my understanding, having heard this in the D.C. rumor mill, that there could be one or two more, and I'll use this term in air quotes, retirements of Republicans. Republican congressmen or women, and that will essentially wreck their majority, and the Democrats might actually, even prior to the election, be forced into the majority themselves because the Republicans can't maintain theirs. Is that an accurate statement?
I mean, that is. The rumor mill is thick with that. So you had, in the last couple of weeks, you had two Republican members of the House, both of whom had already announced they weren't going to run for re-election, but who announced that they were quitting outright. See ya.
Can't stand it anymore.
We're leaving.
Take
one
this
from Colorado
job
and shove it.
Shove it.
Colorado, Wisconsin. And that's what reduced the Republican majority to basically a one-vote majority. In other words, on any vote, if every Republican sticks together
and every Democrat
sticks together, Republicans could only lose one member to lose it. There are, as you said, there are rumors, hints of some other members who may do the same thing, who may literally just quit completely. If two members do that, you're right, there would essentially be enough Democrats there
Who vote as a block.
Who vote as a block to theoretically take over the House right now. As you said, not on the election because of the vote, but because there aren't enough Republicans
to hold.
It's basically like when you have a softball team and you don't have enough players to play in the field and you have somebody out there playing all the outfield. Well, you can't do
rover,
that.
Perhaps.
A rover.
Yes.
You can't do that in Congress. And so,
there's
while
no congressional rover. Got it.
Exactly. And it's certainly, that's a rumor. Nobody is saying for sure that would happen. But you're right. You are at this
But
nice
Speaker Johnson
edge.
Himself said there's a possibility that Minority Leader Jeffries could be the Speaker here in the near future.
Well, if that happens, and part of that, he said that as a threat to the Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, because if they go forward with their plan to try to vacate his position, if Democrats
go along... If a couple Republicans vote for Bokeem Jeffries, then
he's the Speaker. And I think that's still probably... I think this is all still unlikely, just because to have a Republican vote for
right
Democrats
now,
as Speaker...
Right.
It's still unlikely. But again, as you said, if some more Republicans just up and quit...
Or decide that the right flank of the Republican Party is just too difficult to deal with.
Right. And that's a real issue, because I think there are a lot of members, not just moderate Republicans, but even just rank and file conservatives, who are really, for lack of a better word, pissed off at these the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Lauren Boberts and kind of these extreme members who, let's face it, they're a little more interested in being on TV and on Twitter/X than in legislating.
Yeah.
And so you're having a lot of discord in the Republican Party. Just over the weekend, there was a Republican member, I can't remember who it was, but he basically said something along the lines of, on TV, on CNN or wherever, yeah, I work with a lot of scumbags, basically.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that's not really the kind
that's
of...
That's a direct quote, by the way.
Yeah, and that's, again, not the kind of workplace you want to be in, but that's... it's. And he was not talking about the opposition, Democrats.
No, he was talking about
his own
colleagues.
Party. Right.
That's right.
So, yeah, what all this means for the average person is... that at least for the next few months until the election, you're going to have a House that is not barely functional. Congress does have...
As a general rule, it is barely functional.
That's true. Well, it's going to... Okay, more barely or less barely functional.
All barely.
Right. And there's some things coming up. Congress does have to pass some funding to avoid a government shutdown in October. They have to renew the legislative authority for the FAA.
Right.
If you like flying, for example, and you like your planes...
In the air, not hitting
each other, hopefully with the doors not flying off, separate issue. Congress needs to pass...
You know what would be a great idea? If we let the airlines self-inspect those airlines.
There are no bad ideas, John. But, yeah. Well, I think doors are optional. I think it's extra. I think it's like this platinum level or something.
I'll pay for the doors to stay
right, exactly. Right. Yeah, but again, this is the point, is that right now the FAA is investigating this. They are, of course, in charge of the traffic controllers. You need to have an FAA, I feel, personally.
Yeah. I want it to exist.
Right.
Right.
And again, so Congress's inability right now, the House, to get things done or to be very difficult is something that could have impacts on
us. It's compounded.
Never mind all the other issues that we have to deal with, the immigration, the economy, the environment, you name it. That's where I think
How was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Other than that. Now, the good news is, if I can say that, despite all of this, some things are happening now. For example, the aid is getting through. It took a long time, a lot longer than it should have.
But it's
moving
happened.
Forward. I will note also, and this may be good or bad, depending upon where you are, the bill that passed is also going to require TikTok's Chinese owner company, ByteDance, to divest, to sell the company within a year, or they have to shut down. Now, I don't know where, now, John, I don't know, are you a big TikToker? Are you out there doing the TikTok dances and stuff, all the trends? Are you following Taylor and Swift?
No.
No, okay, that's not you. I didn't think so.
I know what TikTok is.
You've heard of it.
I've heard of it?
Yeah.
It seems like not our generation of what we should be looking at.
Well, I think our generation is like what? Like the Captain America and the Hall of Justice.
Right, yeah. MySpace, I think is the
Alta Vista, I think.
Right. And we're all leading toward this discussion about artificial intelligence. And so I'm a little curious how Ukraine funding and TikTok got tossed together, but I do understand that there is apparently a security concern related to who owns the data that is captured by TikTok, and it's hundreds of millions of users.
Right? Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, a very large number of...
And it just so happens that it's a Chinese company, but if you wanted to look at the social media landscape, for instance, if we can call it a social media app, although apparently 70% of its users, this is how they are now getting their news, is from TikTok.
Are we on TikTok, by the way?
No. And we have faces for... audio.
Right, with a face made for radio.
No one ever wants to see us live.
Exactly.
Right. So, yeah, I understand the concerns. I also think it needs to be applied perhaps a little, and this is my personal opinion, perhaps a little more liberally. All social media companies are capturing this data, whether they're owned by a Chinese entity or whether they're owned by Mark Zuckerberg or you and I.
Elon Musk or whatever.
Right. So it is a huge concern in general, and I can understand why this bill exists. I'm not exactly sure why it is tied to funding for things like Ukraine or the conflict in Israel, or even protecting the country of Taiwan.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the reason is China.
And,
somebody once told me years ago, if you want to get policymakers or politicians frightened, just say the word China to them, and that gets them excited. But yeah, so that is, right or wrong, that is the argument, that there is a national security aspect to this. And again, to your point, there's a broader question about data, about privacy. In fact, there is a bill that was just a draft of a bill released by the chairs of the House and Senate Commerce Committees, a Republican and a Democrat, the first major data privacy bill. Not going to move forward this year, most likely, because there's not a lot of time left. And obviously, we know things can't move.
Who can get a bill passed?
Exactly right. But you are seeing more of this interest by Congress in technology and data. Data privacy, and even into AI, and looking at how we do that.
Funny
I should say that.
We've already introduced him, but Gerald, thank you again for being with us and listening to his yammer here in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Really, the pleasure is ours, and thank you for doing this. So talk to us about your company, Trustable. As a segue, what is it? What does it do? Why did you decide to create this company? And what did you see, along the lines of what we just talked about, that necessitated its creation? We give it the floor to you, sir.
Thank you. So Trustable fundamentally is what we call an AI governance software company. So we primarily help enterprises, businesses, governments, nonprofits understand how to develop and deploy AI responsibly. So generally speaking, that's three categories. We help you measure and manage the different benefits and risks of AI systems. We help you comply with regulations and international standards.
Fantastic.
And then we help deliver responsible AI insights, best practices, and recommendations so that you can implement AI with the best-in-class research by your fingertips.
That sounds much needed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, one of the things, you asked what, made us prompt start this company. I spent a little under a decade at a DC company here called FiscalNote. I was an early employee in the company. The company went public in 2022. And right before I left, I was the general manager of our AI line of business. And my co-founder, Andrew, was on the engineering and data science side of the of the platform or of FiscalNote. We were starting to notice essentially three things happen. The first is that organizations had good intentions when they were developing AI. They didn't want to put out a racist or discriminatory chatbot. Right. They just didn't know how to evaluate it. They didn't know what to do in the event that these systems
went wrong.
What happens if? What do I need to know, right? The second thing is that because of those questions, because of the democratization of AI through ChatGPT, you're also starting to see many more stakeholders inside of organizations play an important role, right? Before, AI was really left to data scientists to do fun, cool stuff. Now you have your chief information security officer, your general counsel, your compliance officers, your risk teams, your product, your technology teams. All of these are playing an important role in the development and the business strategy of it, as well as in the governance. And then the third, related to folks that might be interested in this podcast, is the regulatory inflection point that we're likely going to see. So the most notable regulation is in Europe, where they just enacted the EU AI Act. Mm-hmm. This will be similar to Europe's data protection regulation from a few years ago, in the sense that it's going to essentially change how AI gets developed and deployed, and going to put new compliance requirements on basically every organization, in particular those that are developing higher risk systems. But what we realized is that how do you essentially manage all the competing forces that are pushing organizations to make decisions around AI, right? So these are market forces. I need to use AI to increase, you know,
XYZ.
XYZ. And then there are regulatory pressures and forces that are also making...
How do we respond to that?
Absolutely. And so our software platform essentially helps connect all the internal stakeholders that are responsible for governing these systems, helping them very easily adopt best practices, comply with regulations, do risk management, inventory your AI systems, and then importantly, develop very robust policies that you can implement within your organization to give your staff visibility and guidance with respect to what they can or cannot do with AI.
Wow. Okay, so do companies now, do they agree or recognize that they need this kind of governance? I mean, is that something that they're saying,
why does this matter? Yeah.
Why should I do this?
Absolutely. I mean, I talk to several every day. So I think the recognition is, you know, organizations, particularly I would say larger regulated organizations in particular, they want to balance innovation and risk management. Yeah. They know that these are once-in-a-generation technologies, and they know that they need to use them and want to use them. But they're concerned about the risks. They are concerned around fairness and safety and privacy and cybersecurity. They're concerned, but they don't necessarily know what to do. And so with our platform, our entire goal is to help you adopt AI responsibly.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. And so you worked at FiscalNote for a better part of a decade. We've worked together on and off during that time. And we had FiscalNote in studio with
us. Right, about a year ago.
About a year ago, actually. Yeah. And shout out to FiscalNote. So how did you get into this field? What interested you about this? What's your personal story? Like, not just the creation of Trustable, but like, talk to us about your journey from, you know, essentially one of my account managers at FiscalNote to the CEO of this bleeding edge company.
Gosh, we should probably start in my upbringing.
I'm
originally from Puerto Rico, and I've been in D.C. for about 12 years or so.
Yeah.
And, you know, I studied entrepreneurship and political science in school, and my desire when I graduated college was to come here and work, you know, in foreign service and in diplomacy. And I then very quickly realized that getting into that space is a lot harder harder to get in. And eventually I joined a company called CEB, the Corporate Executive Board, which is now owned by Gartner, and then eventually joined FiscalNote early on. But I've always really been passionate at this intersection between technology and policy, right? This confluence of the social things that matter in life and the technology that's moving us forward.
Right.
And it feels to me that DC as a geography, given the caliber of intellectual capacity and talent that's here.
Not counting us, obviously.
Definitely not. Clear.
Present company excluded.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I felt that DC is a great place to start a company that can essentially be the interconnector between Silicon Valley and Washington.
It's one of the reasons why we started this podcast. Absolutely. Right. And so, okay. Assuming that, you know, the question of whether AI is good or bad, you know, we'll set that aside. You fall obviously on the good side. You started a company that wants to help make it better, right? So what do you say to those who dread AI? Why do they dread it? How do we fix their incorrect opinion? What is Trustable doing to do that, both from a corporate and from an individual standpoint? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think there are AI doomers and AI boomers, right? Folks that are fundamentally like the Mark Andreessens of the world, right, that believe that AI is, you know, a very positive thing. And then there's the doomers, the folks that think it is the Terminator experience, right? I actually, you know, we as a company, I would say philosophically, sit in the middle. We are pragmatists.
Right.
We're very excited about some of the opportunities, I think, particularly in healthcare and research, pharmaceuticals, education. These aspects, I think, are really promising. We're also very concerned. The notion of AI being discriminatory or biased or unfair fundamentally is something that motivated us also to help. And so I think when we think about what are the types of AI applications that we want to see moving forward, those are the ones that are being thoughtfully designed for the stakeholders that they're trying to impact, not just put out there in the world without any safety training.
So to sort of address the dread before it happens.
Yeah, I mean, reflection, right? I mean, you know, in many cases, what we're likely going to see for high-risk AI systems, so think of things that have the capacity to impact your employment, so HR software.
Right.
Think of it as financial services AI, healthcare AI, these things that are, you know, potentially risky, right?
Right.
I think what we're likely going to see is that the regulatory environment for them is going to look somewhat similar to maybe how, like, pharmaceutical products get developed, where you actually have to go through product safety and reviews and approvals before these products can actually reach the market. So we're not there yet. We're not there yet, but I think we can certainly see a future, particularly the AI Act, I think, sets the pathway for this, where product safety for some of these issues is going to be incredibly important, particularly those automated decision-making tools.
Which is interesting, because, you know, for those of us in D.C., of course, you're talking about pharmaceuticals. There's a whole agency, a very big agency with a lot of...
I've heard of the FDA.
FDA that does that. There's no, you know, they're there
there's
yet
no, there's no AI.
For AI, which suggests that what could happen down the line, you know, it could be.
Well, I mean, you do have a sitting member of Congress who actually is local to Northern Virginia, Representative Don Beyer, who's going back to school at the tender age of 72.
Oh, right. Yeah.
He's fantastic.
To get his master's
spoken
degree.
And we are part of Don Beyer's district in Virginia, so we've spoken to him, and he's very sharp about this issue. He knows, you know, he's very educated about it.
Which is great, but, you know, again, as you mentioned, that's one member of Congress out of 434. And as previously mentioned on this very podcast, not every member is always up to speed.
Right. Or as sophisticated as Representative.
And there is, I would suggest, and you could disagree, that, you know, policymakers don't always keep up with the technology, or technology moves faster than policy.
Absolutely.
I mean, in your, we talked about this, you know, earlier before this. I mean, in your ideal world, what would kind of the policy framework, regulatory framework look like for AI?
Yeah, there's a couple components here. I think one is around accountability, the other one was around process, and the other one is about maybe distribution of responsibility. So the question around AI is, what is AI? Who is AI? You know, I don't see an environment where there's one agency, for example, that we develop that gets, because AI oversees every sector, right? And so I think what you're likely going to have to do is reinforce existing regulatory agencies to be able to be competent enough to regulate AI within their sectors. So I think, you know, increasing accountability for existing regulators is important. I think the second thing is, you know, you can regulate the technology, right? You can say, hey, you're not, your system can't have these types of outputs. Or you can regulate the people and the process around the technology. Mm-hmm. And I think that's likely going to be the way forward, that policymakers don't understand the speed at which this is moving. They're not technical enough to understand the technology itself.
Right.
But what they're likely going to say is like, hey, if one of these systems goes wrong, I need to hold an individual in that organization accountable. And that accountability mechanism, whether it's through fines or whatever, that's likely going to then, I think, create much more of a safety environment.
Accountability.
I guess in that question, if I could ask, like, who decides then what is wrong? You say if it goes wrong, I mean, who decides?
Who's the decider?
What if something goes wrong? Is it based upon discrimination, false information?
It's the biggest question. It's the biggest. How do you define wrong?
It hasn't been answered yet. Yeah.
Right. I think, you know, what is an appropriate response to an incident that happens with respect to AI, I think is really, I think it's an open-ended question. I'll give you an example. We were talking about airlines. Air Canada, a couple of months ago, I can't remember the exact date, but they had an issue where their chatbot essentially approved a policy or approved a refund based on an outdated policy to a customer. Mm-hmm. And so the customer was all of a sudden said, hey, I interacted with your official Air Canada system.
And they did X.
And they did X, and I deserve a refund. And Air Canada said, no, that was our model. That wasn't us. Simply the model said that, and it referenced the incorrect data.
That employee works here, but so, not anymore.
Right.
The employee, right? So the question mark now lies, who's responsible for this? Is it the company that's responsible for what it communicates to the customer, or is it the model that was essentially communicating based on outdated data?
The input that it was given.
Correct. And so this question of who is ultimately accountable for these types of things, this is a big question mark for a lot of us.
Well, and we were both reading a blog post on Trustable's website about why AI governance is about to get a lot harder. Just perfectly described it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think in this particular circumstance, right, for organizations that are thinking about AI governance, I think there's two dimensions that are moving very quickly. On the one hand, it's the internal dimension, right? There are more applications of AI, more existing software vendors are leveraging AI, more use cases, more people involved, right? So that's complicated. And then you have the external environment, right? The regulatory implications of AI, customer requests and demands to make sure that your AI is safe and secure. So the external environment multiplied by the internal environment is only going to make the environment for AI governance more complex.
Awesome. So you said you talk to a lot of companies every day. How do you think large companies like Google, Microsoft, et cetera, are handling AI, and what could they be doing better?
You know, it's a complicated question.
Of course.
With many layers.
Welcome to our podcast.
Yes, that's what we ask. Look,
if there's one thing that I am optimistic about, is that I think AI safety is, the conversation around AI safety is happening earlier in the technology's maturity lifecycle than with other technologies.
Right.
We didn't have this discussion about social media or about the iPhone.
It just happened.
It just happened.
Right.
And so I am optimistic that this conversation on responsible AI and AI safety and policy is happening relatively early in its infancy. I know that AI is 30, 40 years old. But in general, this is really its heyday.
Right.
So I think that's important. And I think they're leading that conversation. That said, let's also not, kid ourselves that this is the market reality in which we live in. And those orgs are hungry for more data to be able to differentiate their models. They have the capacity through both their B2C and their B2B sides of the business to extend to virtually every individual around the world, and they know it. And so I think while they are advancing the conversation and they're certainly part of the discussion, I think it's important that we also don't fall into regulatory capture, where these companies are also influencing policy to an extent that really only benefits them. And so that's why the conversation around policymakers is so critical, is because we need to create an equitable policy environment that doesn't just take, that certainly provides the resources to the big companies, but also provides the resources to the broader market as well.
Right. So to that point, you mentioned, you said the EU is moving ahead. I mean, how do you think that, and recognize that Europe does things differently than the United States, of course, but how do you think what they're doing in Europe, I mean, how is that working, or how do you think it stacks up?
Yeah, so for some context, the European Union passed the AI Act. So this is similar to the General Data Protection Regulation from a few years ago, GDPR. Yep. And essentially, it does a couple things. Number one, it forces organizations to categorize the various use cases of AI into categories, right? High, medium, or low, and prohibited. Some things are prohibited. And then for things that are higher risk, you have more compliance obligations. For things that are lower risk, you have less compliance obligations. So the notion goes that they're not necessarily trying to negatively impact innovation. They're just trying to do a consumer protection and product safety-oriented regulation. And then the second thing is that there are audits and transparency requirements for general purpose AI systems, right? So these are, think of them as the large language models like OpenAI's or Gemini, these systems that are very, very large and have influence over a lot of different things. And so, we'll see what the impact of the European Union's law is. It also, who is the arbiter of how it goes, right? If it's associated with innovation and market power, I don't necessarily think that it'll be a pro-innovation regulation, for sure. Mm-hmm. America innovates and, EU regulates.
Right.
However, it will certainly create a global framework, much like GDPR did. It'll create a global framework for how you're supposed to regulate or govern artificial intelligence that organizations around the world will follow.
Well, you thank you for that. And you just said something very interesting. So America innovates and EU regulates. So EU is ahead of this from a regulation standpoint. One of the concerns about regulating AI from a policymaker standpoint is the fact that technology advances happen much faster than policy and regulatory infrastructure can move. And we talked about this on our very first episode with former Congressman Russ Carnahan, right, who basically said, we need business to lead so we can make good policy that will allow business to continue. If we lead, business can't respond quick enough to the policy, right? So how do we ensure responsible government governance, and is that even something governments can do?
I think it goes back to accountability, right? I think, you know, you can use your existing laws to extend into artificial intelligence, right? That to make sure that you have an existing regulatory apparatus that is capable of being flexible with new technologies.
Right.
And I think you hold accountability on the individuals. I think the technology itself will take its own dimension. You know, we oftentimes talk about, is AI really that different from other types of technologies that, right, we've developed in the past? And I think you can make arguments either on either side. I will say we've never really developed a technology that mimics human cognition. And so, right, we actually don't, like, this is an uncharted territory. I don't really think that there's any clarity with respect to how this will or will not impact jobs or how it will impact general kind of society structure just yet.
Mm. Right, right. So, you know, we're talking a lot about kind of the impact of sort of regulation or policy on AI, but there's also the other side of the coin, which is AI's impact on policy and elections. So we have an election coming up, you may have heard.
No, no.
No, yeah, so yeah.
Who's on the ballot?
Right.
Ron Beyer.
What's at stake?
Nothing, nothing at stake. You know, and I've heard people...
Democracy.
In Washington, right. The stakes are very low. I've heard people in D.C., other places, worried about sort of what they call AI in the broadest sense, everything from, you know, deep fakes, misinformation, all sorts of things that could influence it. You know, how do you see that kind of AI impacting this political and policy process, either good ways or bad?
Yeah. So I think there's a scary thing,
right,
which is everything you mentioned, right? I think
the worst case scenario.
Deep fakes and the like. I think, you know, we should very clearly provide guidelines to political parties with what they are allowed and not allowed to do and disclose accordingly. But my problem or my concern is not really around political parties or the candidates. It's actually about outside actors, right?
Yeah.
When we think about, you know, Russia, China, other geopolitical actors.
Or just individuals.
Or just individuals, right? Of course. Access to open source models, best-in-class open source models that can generate any type of image or any type of,
right,
text, are so ubiquitous that anyone around the world can essentially use it to infiltrate our elections. So I think that part of it is very scary. The non-state actors in the open source environment, I think the dual source of that is something that scares me. I think on the other side, though, I think, you know, candidates during this election cycle also have a responsibility to level set society around AI. I think there's a lot of fear from a lot of folks, and there's a lot of excitement, but there's mostly a lot of fear. And so I think they have an obligation to kind of level set. What does it mean for our districts, for our states, for our country? What does it mean for you as an individual? What is the world going to look like?
Right.
And how do we help shape it? Because I think if you start the conversation with fear, with Terminator, where they're going to take our jobs, then I think you've already lost. But if you actually...
yeah.
If, right, you actually position the conversation in a way that, what are the ways in which society is actually, or AI is going to benefit our life, right? The advances in healthcare and medicine, the advances in access to education, all of these things are very good, positive things, but you have to know how to balance that conversation. And that's an obligation, I think, that they have in this election cycle.
Awesome. So we talked a little bit about the criticism of AI, you know, bias, in that it's only as good as basically your input,
right?
Right, and until, you know, much of that knowledge base then can betray a certain bias, right? So is truly objective AI and AI governance possible based on that?
What does objective mean?
Well,
wow,
without bias, right? How do the people who...
How do you define bias?
That's just it. How do the people who are inputting the parameters that set up the AI avoid the bias? Let's start there.
I'm of the belief it's impossible to avoid the bias. The bias is an inherent quality of human nature, and these systems reflect the decisions or the trade-offs that humans design it for.
So you're saying that we should be aware that the bias exists and then have the foresight and fortitude to go back and fix it if it manifests.
Or at least recognize that it's right. there.
Well, I think it's about recognizing that it could exist. I think it's defining what bias means to you and yeah. making a very clear determination of where... So I'll give you a perfect example, right? Hiring algorithms right. are known for being...
For having bias.
For yeah. having bias, right? Discriminating against
racial,
candidates,
racial... Age, you name it.
Everything, right? Every characteristic. Humans are also biased when they make decisions
we
in
are.
Hiring,
we are.
Right?
I didn't like the way that guy looked.
Right. And so in many ways, you can design a system with biases that either reflect your organization's principles or the law, right? What does the law require you to do? Right. And so I think it's impossible to fully detach bias from the issue of AI, but I think it's certainly possible to ensure that organizations have the right level of care and attention as it relates to right. setting up their own bias.
Well, it's hard because I remember an example recently, I think it was Gemini, which and somebody had tested it and asked, who was worse, Otto Fittler or Elon Musk? And it came back and said, well, on one hand, Elon Musk sent some tweets, things like that. On the other hand, Otto Fittler.
Plenty of good people on both
right.
sides.
Right. You know, and people kind of said, this isn't, you're crazy. You could argue, I mean, offering an opinion is bias in a way, but then not offering an opinion in a situation like that. So it does in many ways come back to kind of the users yeah. and that human interaction.
Definitely. I think with respect to generative AI, we want generative AI to almost foreshadow what the world is going to look like, mm-hmm. but we don't want it to recreate history. And I think right. that's one of the things that's really interesting about the Gemini example. So there was another Gemini example where essentially Google designed the system to be diverse in nature, right? So right. One of the issues with, for example, image generators a year ago was that you would say, paint me an issue or give me an image of a CEO. And I think something like 94% of the time it was a white man
right.
displayed.
Right.
And then give me a picture of a nurse. And almost like 75% of the time it was a female as a nurse.
Right.
And so these are right the biases that are reflected in these systems. Now, what Google did is I want to actually force the system to be more diverse. And so when I ask an image of or someone to create an image of a CEO, I want it to be half female, half male in the future,
right.
et cetera. But what happened was that people started saying, okay, give me an image of a Nazi. And it was essentially giving them an image of a black person as a Nazi officer.
Right.
And people
That's
were
diverse.
Obviously outraged That's, because right. essentially like there was no such thing.
right.
And so this is where like these are like good intentions, right? Google had good intentions.
Of
they
course.
Wanted to create a diverse future of what representation from these AI models should look like, but it ended up hurting them, right? And so
right.
this is where the conversation of bias is so difficult that oftentimes show your work is kind
yeah.
of what we would likely expect to a lot of
right.
companies.
So if I could ask, and again, this is something that, and getting a little silly now, but I mean, you hear some people talk about AI and, you know, eventually, you know, the machines...
Let's be silly.
Well, machines will get smarter than humans, and, you know, our robot overlords will take over things like
Welcome
that.
Welcome to Skynet.
For the record, I don't believe that
right.
entirely.
Shout out to the overlords.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you, overlords. I mean, are those fears, are they insane? Is there any reason to be, to fear that, to think that? Is that possible?
Look, we have the kill switch, right? So I think humans are in control in a catastrophic event that I really do think that we have the kill switch. So my perspective is that it is unlikely if we were to go that direction.
But what if the robots get the kill switch? I'm kidding.
Then I think we're doomed.
No, kidding.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I'll be back.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, again... I think there's some very real issues with AI today that we should be focused on. I think
right.
there's some other folks, very much smarter folks than I am, dedicated on the issue of existential threats
right.
around AI. That's not me. I'm focused on the today issue.
Issues of bias and copyright and those sort of things.
All of those.
Are much more here now.
But certainly, I think as a member of the human race, I am hopeful and cautiously optimistic that we'll get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But the stakes are very high.
Right. So just a question. If you had, say, 30 seconds with President Biden or former President Trump or somebody, what would your message be to them? about AI?
Gosh, I don't mean to seem ageist, but maybe retire.
go back to George Mason and get your master's degree like Don Beyer.
Exactly, yeah.
Look, I think treat this as the most important technology that humanity has ever created, because right. I think it is what it is. And I think ensure that society and citizens are well-educated on the benefits and the risks. And I think if they can do one thing, it's increase individual accountability when things go wrong. And when I say individual accountability, I mean an executive
actual
responsible
individuals. Right.
Actual individual.
Don't blame the software or
don't
model.
Blame the game,
right.
blame
because
the player.
Humans, right. I mean, executives fundamentally work on incentives. And if right. the classic, if I can just pay the fine, I can get it done,
yeah.
I think that will not work for these
right.
extremely important policy questions that we have in the future.
Great answer. So talk to us about Trustable. What's next? What's happening? What big things are coming yeah. down the pike?
Well, you actually caught us in an interesting day. We released a press release earlier this morning.
I saw.
Where we are essentially creating, think of it as ESG scores or credit ratings for
wow.
AI models.
Wow.
So we've evaluated 21 different large language models, so think GPT-4 or Anthropic's Claude or Llama 2 or some of these others, and essentially evaluated them against transparency disclosures. So do they disclose their data sources, their training methodology, their architecture, their energy consumption? We have 30 different characteristics.
So you can develop a scorecard.
We can develop a yeah. scorecard, and we're essentially enabling orgs to have a more informed decision with respect to what model they may want to select for any given purpose. Because when you
right.
talk to AI leaders, they're like, okay, I want to use AI. There's three considerations on which AI system I use. There's performance on a given task, there's cost, and then there's risk. But they have no idea about the risk because
Run.
These systems don't disclose anything.
Right.
They don't know if there's toxic content in the data.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Yeah.
And so what we attempted to do here was essentially provide visibility and insights to create a framework for how you should evaluate different models. Right now, we're starting with large language models. Over time, we'll go and expand into other categories of AI systems, as well as other categories beyond transparency, right? And going into ethical, legal, or other types of risks. I think that's certainly on the insights portion. I think on the core software platform in terms of, what we're up to, I think we certainly see an opportunity to expand globally, both in the U.S. and in Europe. I think, obviously, the EU AI Act becomes a catalyst for business for us, so we want to be able to support organizations that are operating across both and multiple, jurisdictions.
Right.
And then I think, for us, if we can help organizations accelerate their AI development process, but making sure that they have a framework for evaluating, managing, mitigating, measuring the risks, then I think that's success for us.
That's great.
It sounds hugely, potentially amazing. That's fantastic. Thanks for being here, man.
Yeah, thank you for having
me. It was great. Thank you.
This was immensely helpful and informative and enlightening. We'd like to have you back on.
Of course.
All right.
Happy to.
And in the near future, let us know what's going on with Trustable. We can circle back with that certainly when we have you back, but keep us posted. And enjoy the beautiful weather here in our nation's capital.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerome.
Thank you so much.
And so we're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about what we've learned, which is an enormous amount from Gerald.
More than we can handle.
Right, usually. And we're going to talk about what's coming up for the podcast. So we have some really great guests coming up. And we'll be back in a couple minutes. Thank you. And we're back from the break.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
I will admit this. I feel dumb when I talk to Gerald sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he mentioned some of the different kinds of language, like Llama 2 and I don't know, Alpaca 3 and things like that. It's a little bit like, well, I don't know. I know Basic and Fortran, but that's it. But I mean, it's...
Right. I mean, we were talking about MySpace earlier. Right.
But yeah. Glad there are people like him who understand this.
And who are ethically approaching
right.
the governance of this incredibly important thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck when he said, we asked him, you know, what would you say to the president? He said, you know, this is, I can't remember how he put it, like the most important technological
accountability.
Advance. Yeah. You know, you think about
individual
something that has enormous power and benefit, but yes, could also have some
the
big,
opposite.
Some big downsides. Right. But, you know, the thing that strikes me is I was on a call recently with a group of people and asking about AI, and some people were like, yeah, I'm using it. I'm using ChatGPT. And others were like, no, I never use AI. And the reality is we are all using it in some way or
another.
Whether
you like to admit it or not.
Whether you admit it or not. Every time your
whether you know
email auto-finishes or you're going on to Amazon, I mean, you're using it in some way or
Alexa,
another.
Alexa, reorder my back pills.
Pajamas
like,
or
whatever. Yeah.
I don't know why you came up with back pills and I came up with pajamas.
Because we're old.
We're old, exactly. That's right. Yeah, we're tired.
We've learned that we're old and tired, and we've learned that Gerald is a really bright guy who's doing really important things, and his company is sort of uniquely poised to be able to help us with a lot of that.
Yeah, I think so, and that's really important, and it gives you comfort that there are folks out there like him and this company that are thinking about these issues and working to help those who are pushing the boundaries of AI do it in a way that is responsible and thoughtful and protects the consumer and the public.
Yeah, truly. So we have some exciting episodes, not just this one, coming up. Yeah. Next month in May, we are going to be talking to the executive director of a public interest organization, a 501c3, called the Attachments Energy Rating Council, that certifies and regulates the energy efficiency of window attachments, things that our corporate sponsor, Somfy, is directly related to. And his name is Ralph Vasami. Ralph and I go back longer than you and I have known each other, 20, 25 years. Ralph is a great guy and regulatory attorney from New York City. He has a long and storied career in association management and advocacy. And we're going to have him to talk to us about AERC, the Attachments Energy Rating Council, and what it is up to. It has a face-to-face board meeting at the end of May here in our nation's capital. And you and I will be helping them do a Hill visit.
They'll be up on Capitol Hill talking to congressional committees and members of Congress about the real importance of attachments, the energy efficiency benefits, and really the implications of how policy can help make buildings more energy efficient.
That's amazing. And then in June, we have a return guest.
Our first return guest, first two-timer.
A two-timer. He's going to be. We should hand out velvet jackets like
we do. Well, it's five. I think it's five times. Well, maybe two. We'll start.
We'll start with maybe three.
Sure, a vest. Maybe it's just a vest.
A vest, a scarf.
Yeah.
A pencil. Comedian J.L. Coven, who some of you heard as part of our holiday extravaganza episode, will be in studio with us live. He is in town at the end of June doing a comedy gig at the D.C. Comedy Loft, which you and I will be attending, of course, to see J.L. Perform his comedy. But he's going to be here in studio with us, making us laugh at ourselves and the ridiculous things going on in our nation's capital. Yeah. And in July and August, we have some great guests as well.
July, Jenna Hamilton, who's an official with GBI, the Green Building Initiative, which is one of the leading organizations out there that is really pushing the
green building ratings.
On green building ratings, the kind of tools that building developers use to make sure their buildings are sustainable, reduce carbon footprint, use less energy.
That sounds
like somebody who we've worked with on and off for
years.
Again, 20 years as well.
She's great.
The vanguard of that.
In
August, we have David Downey, who is the president and CEO of a group called the International Downtown Association. And this is the international association for what people often know as business improvement districts.
The BIDs.
And these are folks who are working to make downtowns all over the U.S. and around the world vibrant,
so livable. These are economic development people and real estate developers coming together to do business.
To do business, but also create places that are vibrant, that are livable. They do actual work literally on the street.
Like an urban planning.
Yeah, make streets safe, vibrant, activate events, things like that. And so with this period of time, when you see this transition, people working from home more and more, you know, it's a time of a change for downtowns. So it's going to be, it's a really exciting time to be talking about what that means and what the policy implications are for that.
Well, that's a lot.
That's for August. So
that's for August.
We'll be at the beach doing it.
No summer breaks for us,
exactly.
Folks. Exactly. And so this is an exciting time for the podcast.
In September, Taylor Swift, who knows?
Who knows? Travis Kelce?
We're not saying no.
And all the Swifties?
Exactly.
Sure. I will say that it is exciting in that when we first started this project, Andrew and I, we were really struggling trying to figure out who our guest structure right. would be, getting them in studio or live via Zoom or you know, some sort of online media source. And now we're 4 or 5 months out, replete with guests and thousands of listeners. So we can't thank you, the listener, enough for your support and your assistance in this effort and our yammering.
Yeah, and thanks to, of course, to Big Wig Media and their fantastic studio.
And right Evergreen
Stone
Podcast Network.
White House.
And yeah, Evergreen. Really.
Absolutely.
And our corporate sponsor, Somfy. We wouldn't be here without you. So all that to say, I am John Lawyer, your host.
I'm Andrew Goldberg, your co-host.
And thank you so much for listening to the Political Shadings Podcast. We will be with you next month. Talk to you soon.